It's time for a piece of the action here on this beautiful Sunday. That's right, the skies are grey, it's raining, and isn't it wonderful? It's like that sometimes. I think it's Clayton here in the hot seat along with Sue Gilbey today, and we've got a pretty interesting interview coming up for you, a pre-recorded one. But before we get to that, this, first of all, an acknowledgement that this is Kaurna Space and Kaurna Airspace, and we acknowledge and recognise the continuing custodianship of the Kaurna people to this land we call home, Adelaide.
Always was, always will be.
Hmm.
So, Clayton, this is a conversation that I had with the Senior Public Health Fellow and Investigative Journalist, David Tuller, and he's from the UC Berkeley. And there's also a couple of local advocates for Penelope McMillan and Tanya Ems for what is known as ME-CFS. And these are conditions that are really quite challenging and huge, and it blew my mind, I've got to tell you. There's stigma. It's definitely a social justice thing. We don't often talk about health issues on this program, but the social justice of this is huge. It's a serious and complex disease, and you'll obviously hear a lot more about it and hear some what ME-CFS actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll get you to say, you know, well, you've got to beg the question, who is David Tuller?
Well, David's qualifications are he's got a Master's of Public Health followed by a PhD in Public Health. He's currently a Senior Fellow in Public Health and Journalism at the Centre of Global Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley campus. And over the last couple of years, he's used his wide experience in investigative journalism to report extensively on medical scandals involving this chronic condition of ME-CFS. And that isn't after our summer fire season, the country fire service. It's the chronic fatigue syndrome. So he's also got a blog that you might be interested in called Trial by Error. So he's basically debunking the accepted treatment of ME and CFS in our medical system. Penelope McMillan, who's also in this interview, is a chair of the ME-CFS organisation in South Australia, a director on the national board as well. She's been ill with CFS for 20 years and a spokesman during the last 3 years. And Tanya Ems is a social justice advocate who's been living with ME-CFS for 38 years. Her illness has followed the relapsing and partial remitting cycles across the spectrum from bedbound on a DSP through to part-time work and short periods of full-time employment. Tanya's background's in nutritional science, and she was involved in a clinical ME-CFS treatment research and symptom management for 10 years in her own practice and with Bioscreen at Bio21 Institute at the Uni of Melbourne.
There's lots of nuances in this interview, and it is all about treatment and what the authorities deem treatment to be. There's all sorts of different threads that we can draw on, and I think we need to look at this and hear this interview today and take it up, because there's just so much that's in it. But just to let you know, ME is myalgic encephalomyelitis, and chronic CFS is chronic fatigue syndrome. They're now put together as ME/CFS, and it's a common but poorly understood condition that actually devastates lives, and it can have all sorts of effects. They can be physical, cognitive, and emotional. So the key theme of this conversation that we had, I think, is the fact that there's two things known as graded exercise therapy and CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy, which is used as people have to do it to actually be in the running to qualify under the NDIS for any disability assistance. And this has been totally debunked.
So the science is not only not there, but it's actually been proven to be incorrect.
Exactly. And this conversation will show that.
And on the other side of things, people with ME-CFS often experience stigma and isolation. Patients, many of them living in extreme poverty, have crowdfunded to bring David to Australia. Professional medical organisations and government agencies have not listened to people with ME-CFS who've tried to explain both the dangers and ineffectiveness of graded exercise therapy. David's presence here has opened doors and enabled communication with important brokers in health, welfare and disability. The hope is that this may be a new beginning in medical care and social justice for people struggling with ME/CFS.
I really hope so. I really hope so. I was so moved by this.
Here's part one of the interview.
My name is David Toller. I'm at the University of California, the Berkeley campus. My position there, I'm a senior fellow in public health and journalism at a center called the Center for Global Public Health, which is part of the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. I've been a journalist for many years. I got a doctorate in public health about 5 years ago when I was at the advanced age of 56. So mainly I've been a journalist, and this is a project I've been working on for about 3 years, sort of trying to expose the bad science in this field of either ME or chronic fatigue syndrome or ME/CFS or CFS-ME or whatever name one chooses to call it.
Okay, and we have two other people in the room. Would you like to introduce yourselves as well?
So I'm Penelope McMillan, and I do a lot of advocacy around ME/CFS. I'm currently the chair of the South Australian ME/CFS organisation and on the board of the national body. And then I also do a lot of health consumer advocacy side of ME/CFS in the broader arena.
Hi everyone, I'm Tanya Evans. I'm a local ME activist, and I'm also a sufferer. So I've had this condition for 38 years now, so it's a long haul for me.
38 years?
Yes, yes. Going a relapsing and remitting, or partially remitting phase, so I've achieved some, you know, really great able-bodied stuff in my downtimes, or my uptimes I should call them, but a lot of it's been quite difficult and bed-bound, including the last 2 years, so I'm a low-key activist. Keyboard warrior at the moment.
So one of the things for me is that I hear people who've been sick for so long and haven't really been able to get, you know, treatment. I mean, there's no approved treatment that's been proven to work for everybody. People don't get services. They're not believed. You know, and so hearing stories like Tanya's or other people who've been sick for so long and just sort of been ignored, it was sort of shocking to me when I started looking into it as a journalist.
You're here in Australia for a particular reason?
Well, so last year what happened was I was doing this, I had a position at Berkeley, a half-time position, faculty on the journalism and public health schools, and that had been continuing for about 8 or 10 years. And so last year, sort of funding ran out, a grant ended that I had, and funding ran out for that particular position at Berkeley. So I ended up doing what I never had intended to do. And I had been working on this reporting about this illness as a side project just because. So it was kind of a public service project. But then I had no salary coming in after June 30th last year, and no benefits, which in the U.S. is health insurance. So I had to figure out a way to earn some money. So I crowdfunded for the project I'd been doing for free, and that money went to Berkeley so it could cover my salary and benefits. So this project became my Berkeley job, half-time. And as part of my crowdfunding, I had been in contact with a lot of patients from Australia, you know, around the world. I'd get emails from people, and I'd wanted to come to Australia. So I said, well, if I reach my goal, I'm coming to Australia. So I got some more money from Australia. And then, you know, the year's coming to an end in June. And so I had to, you know, put up or shut up. I promised to come, and here I am. And so I came for 6 weeks. And so basically, I've sort of been at the disposal of the community. I've been in, as I said, I started in Melbourne. I went to Canberra. I was in Sydney for a week. Then I was in Hobart. Then I've been here. Today I'm going to Perth for a week. Then I'm going to Brisbane, Gold Coast, and then a couple of days in Lismore, and then I'm going home. So I've been here 4 weeks. I'll be here for another two. And in each sort of city, basically, the local coordinator, working with other people, has set up, in this case, Penelope, has set up, you know, either interviews and a talk or, you know, informational meetings. I've also interviewed people because I'm still sort of posting on my blog as I'm, you know, doing stuff here. So it's been sort of a mix of things. I sort of said, whatever, you know, you think is useful, I'm happy to do. Wherever you want me to go, I'm happy to go.
So is it a bit of an indictment on society that you needed to crowdfund?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, there's no fun. I mean, there hasn't been any funding for research except the bad research that's been done relative to the treatments and, you know, quotation marks of cognitive behavior therapy and graded exercise therapy. But so there's been very little money in Australia, almost nothing for other kinds of research except some private money. So no government money. In the US, just the last couple of years, it's being taken more seriously. So the government funding agencies have increased funding. But there's certainly no interest in it in the academic world. And so, you know, and certainly from my perspective as a journalist, there hasn't been any interest in it in the media world. So basically nobody's interested in this disease. And so, you know, I didn't really have any choice but to crowdfund, which wasn't something that I particularly was interested in doing. But yeah, it should be funded. I should be getting paid by normal people and not by patients. But you have to go where the money is. Or, you know, the patients don't have money, but they have a little bit of money and they're helping to sort of fund my work.
And I think to me, what I'm constantly having to say to people is that this is not a rare condition.
Yeah.
This is a really common condition.
Yeah.
The government statistics put the disability adjusted life years, which is a way of comparing levels of disability. People with mild ME/CFS have a level of disability higher than a lot of conditions that are accepted as very disabling, let alone if you have moderate or severe ME/CFS, in which case someone like Tanya is far more disabled than people who get services, people, communities for which there is massive research funding, communities that have government-funded services to support the individuals. This is a common condition. It's an extremely disabling condition. And that's not our words, that's government numbers. And yet, it's treated as though we're a very, very small marginal group who don't really, almost as though we don't deserve the money, yeah. The attention, the respect.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, comes back to the sad indictment on society that we're constantly asked to justify ourselves and justify our sickness. And in fact, that's caused me to actually isolate myself so much because I just do not have the energy to spare to constantly justify myself to others, you know, that I'm actually, you know, deserving and I'm actually really, really sick. And you couldn't find a more proactive bunch of people in our community who just want to suck the juice out of life and live life, but they are very sick and we're disabled. And to have to justify that is like a double...
it's an insult, isn't it?
It's an insult. Thank you.
Let's just say right now that this is a serious, devastating, often physiological, organic disease. It's not clear. It's probably a cluster of illnesses. So it's not really clear exactly what's happening. But what seems to happen is that most people get a viral infection or glandular fever, for example, or a bad flu, or possibly a bacterial infection, or it might be exposure to an environmental toxin or mold, or there might be multiples of that. And in people who are susceptible, and they seem to have perhaps a genetic predisposition because it runs in families, it seems to trigger kind of a hyperimmune and hyperinflammatory response. Whenever the initial infecting agent seems to go away, but people are left with this response, and seems to have happened is that it triggers also a dysfunction in their mitochondria, it seems, perhaps. That's what these data seem to be indicating. So they're not producing, at a cellular level, they're not producing sufficient energy. So to refer to it as chronic fatigue syndrome, as if people are just kind of tired or lazy or don't want to do anything, is just ridiculous. It's a horrible name for a serious illness. And everybody basically who was involved in creating that name, and that was at the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. in 1988, pretty much regrets their name on that paper. Because I've talked to a number of the people on that paper, and they're all, yeah, it's a terrible name. But that's the name that's gotten stuck with, as opposed to the original name that predated that, which is ME, which stands for myalgic encephalomyelitis, which nobody can pronounce, but it actually sounds like a disease.
It does.
They've done studies when you give medical students charts and show them, you know, this disease with a serious name like that, or chronic fatigue syndrome, they all say that the chronic fatigue syndrome people are less severely impaired than the ones, even though the charts are exactly the same, they just put a different name on top of it. So the name of the disease has seriously and negatively impacted the experience of people in the world, like Tanya, who you don't want to explain yourself constantly to people about that. Yes, you are sick, and this happens with spouses, employers, friends. You know, people, marriages fall apart. Their kids don't believe them sometimes. You know, they're rejected by their siblings. You know, so basically, it's a really difficult thing. One, just to have the illness, which is so incredibly disabling, and two, to have it really completely misunderstood by pretty much everyone around you. And that's been completely enabled and abetted by the medical system and all the schemes that we develop in society to try to help take care of people. They've all sort of adopted this delusion that it's just kind of some weird, vague laziness or tiredness that people have, and that's really not what it is at all. It's a serious medical disorder that's happening at the cellular level where people are not able to produce sufficient energy to do things.
Can't you change the name? Because it does just lead people to say, oh, I get tired too.
Yes, exactly. And every time I post something on Facebook, for example, I have a friend, or not every time, but often a friend of mine who's not sick. You know, I mean, most of my friends don't have this. I'm just working on this as a project. And so I'll always have a friend who'll say, oh, reading that makes me so tired, thinking that they're making a joke, not realizing that people with the illness have heard that joke about 30 times a day for the last 25 years. So it does lead to well-intentioned but really insulting things from people. And it's not easy to change a disease name when everything in the literature, it's researched a certain way, the bureaucratic systems call it a certain way. You can't just, it's not just patients who can decide, oh, I'm going to call it, you know, whatever disease. And so there have been efforts it has changed, because it used to be in the U.S., for example, chronic fatigue syndrome was what it was called, but now the government agencies are calling it ME/CFS, so they're recognizing that chronic fatigue syndrome is a bad name, but nobody can move immediately, it seems, just to saying ME. In the U.S., nobody actually knows what ME is. In Australia, it's different, because it was ME before the CDC in the U.S. came up with the name chronic fatigue syndrome. Then, because of sort of psychiatrists and others who got involved in the UK, it became much more common to call it chronic fatigue syndrome. So that got adopted in the UK, in Australia too. So here, people know what ME is, but mainly they call it chronic fatigue syndrome.
Well, a few people know what ME is. I don't think in general people know what ME is here.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that push for SEID a couple of years ago, which was systemic.
SEID.
SEID.
Exertion intolerance disease. Whatever you might want to chat about.
Okay.
So one of the problems with the name is that fatigue is a misnomer, because it really isn't fatigue, and the fatigue itself is not the main symptom. The cardinal symptom is really that people get a flu, some kind of bad infection, so maybe it's bacterial, or they get some exposure, then they get sick, then they get over that, but they seem to have a continual episode of things. And the main symptom is that it's causing this dysfunction at the cellular level, where if they overexert themselves, if they do more than their bodies, energy than their bodies can produce, you know, I might go to the gym and work out a bit too much, and then I rest for an hour, and that's the end of it. They do something where they go make a cup of coffee, or they go walk to the store. They've way exceeded their energy capacity, and then they may have a crash for a week. So this crash, which is prototypical in pretty much every sufferer, is called post-exertional malaise, which is also a bad word, malaise, because it sounds like a Victorian fainting spell. But in the U.S., there's a body called the Institute of Medicine, which is now called the National Academy of Medicine, which is kind of an advisory arm to the government in terms of medical issues. And they did a study of all the literature, and they identified this post-exertional relapse as the core symptom. So they didn't want to call it post-exertional malaise. They called it exertion intolerance, which is also not a very good name, but they called it systemic exertion intolerance disease. So nobody likes that name, and nobody has adopted it. The one good thing about that report was that it made it clear that this is in no way a psychiatric disorder. It's in no way related to deconditioning, which has been the standard hypothesis, that people think they're sick and so they stay in bed and then they get very deconditioned, and that's causing all the symptoms. What it did was it took chronic fatigue syndrome and put, instead of fatigue, it put exertion intolerance at the center of the name to indicate that that's the core symptom. Even though SEID is a bad name also, SEID or whatever, however one would pronounce it, nobody's adopted the name, but everybody agrees that exertion intolerance or post-exertional malaise or this, you know, severe relapse that people have is the core symptom. If you don't have that, you just have prolonged fatigue for whatever other reason, but not because you have this particular illness, or it's probably a cluster of illnesses. So, but it's characteristic of this thing that people have that we're calling chronic fatigue syndrome or ME is this relapse. So if you don't have that, you may be sick, but you have something else.
So one of the main recognized forms of treatment is cognitive behavior therapy, as I've been reading. Even that implies that there's some form of cognition training required.
That's a complicated thing because there's two main treatments that have been considered sort of de facto standard of care. One is cognitive behavior therapy and one is something called rated exercise therapy, where the idea is that you increase your activity levels to get reconditioned yourself. So the idea that the psychiatrists had when they promoted this theory is that people get an initial infection or viral illness or glandular fever, they go to bed for a month, then by the time that's gone, they're very deconditioned, so they try to do something and they feel bad and they don't think, oh, I'm just deconditioned, I have to keep being active. They think, oh my God, I have an ongoing underlying, you know, disease, I have to go back to bed. Then they go back to bed for a month and they get even more deconditioned and try again, and they get into what they call a vicious cycle of deconditioning, sleep dysregulation, that leads to depression, all this kind of stuff. So they have two therapies that they've, you know, proposed to deal with that. One is graded exercise therapy, so that you increase your activity, you know, by 10% a week or 20% every 2 weeks or whatever it is, to recondition yourself. And the other is cognitive behavior therapy. So most cognitive behavior therapy is fine. If you have cancer, if you have multiple sclerosis, if you have any bad life trauma, you might get some cognitive behavior therapy to help you figure out how to adapt to your circumstances. Because having a bad circumstance obviously creates a lot of psychological issues of how do you adjust to that. So that's normal. This is a specific kind of cognitive behavior therapy designed by this group of psychiatrists and psychologists in the UK, where the goal isn't just regular to help you adapt to your horrible circumstances. It's to they posit that you have unhelpful beliefs or dysfunctional cognitions about having an organic illness. So the goal of the cognitive behavior therapy is not to help you adapt to your terrible illness, it's to help you unadapt to the fact that you think you have an illness and to alleviate you of that kind of belief so that you can get back to all the things you were doing before. So when people say, well, why do people object to cognitive behavior therapy? You do it for cancer. Well, if you do it for cancer, nobody's telling you you're going to recover from your cancer because you did cognitive behavior therapy. But that's what they've been basically telling people now for 3 decades who have this illness, that this is not just it's not a management for your condition, it's a treatment for the illness. So it's always appropriate to have some therapy if you're having difficulty dealing with the reality of your circumstances. That's management of your condition. That's very different from treatment of the underlying cause of the illness, which they posit that this is, and really it's not, because these people generally do not have false cognitions about their illness. They're very sick. They know they're sick. Their bodies know they're sick. So they're not making it up. But that's what's sort of posited in the application of cognitive behavior therapy for this particular illness, which is why the patients object to it.
It really is a double whammy, isn't it? It's almost like saying everybody gets tired and it's all in the mind.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. The psychiatrists actually believe that people have serious symptoms. They just think the symptoms are if they still believe this, I would doubt, because there's been a lot of research coming out since they posited this theory. But their framework has been that people, don't. So they believe that the symptoms are real. They just think the symptoms are coming from deconditioning and not from having an actual dysfunction at the cellular level.
I think it's a phrase that's worth including here is that they describe it as a false illness belief.
Yeah.
So Tanya and I, we're not sick. We have a false illness belief, which is producing our disability, producing our symptoms. You know, I'm wearing a heart rate monitor. It's my false illness belief that makes my heart misbehave. Right? I mean, when you put it like that, you go, well, where did these people come from?
Mm-hmm.
to take people who've got measurable, very measurable disabilities, very measurable symptoms. These are not imaginary symptoms. And they go, oh, yes, but the cause of those symptoms is your false illness belief.
Well, and what that makes you do, which is be too sedentary, and then you become deconditioned. So the core is that your false illness beliefs lead to sedentary behavior, so you stay in bed, and that causes all the symptoms, which then reinforce your idea that you have an illness. That's the paradigm. And it's, I mean, it would be one thing if they did research and proved it. The problem is their research is all completely bogus, and they've unproved it, but then they kind of, in the biggest case that I focused on, the biggest trial, they sort of manipulated all their data after the fact. They changed all the measures, the way they were looking at things, and so even though they got basically no minimal or no results from these treatments, after they changed all the way they measured everything, they seemed to have results that showed that it worked. So the problem is not just that they have this terrible theory, is that they tried to prove the theory was correct and prove that it wasn't correct. And at the point that point, they seemed to have changed all the way they measured their outcomes and reported in the studies that they were published that they had some success, when in fact that was only because they changed their outcome measures after the trial. They collected all their data.
So a really important factor from this study is...
It's called the PACE study.
Yeah, the PACE study is one of the things, and only one that's wrong with it, is that they've got a measure for how well people are. It's a well-accepted measure. And they know that in the normal population, people have a score of 80 or above if they're healthy. So they said, oh, well, if you have a score of 65, you're disabled and you can come into our study. Now, once they got their data in, they changed their minds and said, people are recovered if they have a score of 60. Now, just remember that at 65, we're disabled.
Disabled enough to enter the study.
Disabled enough to enter the study. And now, at 60, so you could actually get worse, you were deemed recovered. So when people applied for...
On that measure.
So when people... this in
yes,
the Lancet.
In the Lancet. So when people apply for the NDIS, where you're required to have a permanent disability, they would say, this study shows that if you get up off your bed and exercise, you can recover. So therefore, your condition is not permanent. 38 years for Tanya, what if she just got out of bed and... Yeah, if she just got out of bed and exercised
more. I have done that. I've done CBT, I've done graded exercise therapy quite a few times, and I can tell you it made me so sick, it put me into a severe relapse, and I was in bed for many, many, many months, bedridden, having to be cared for. And, you know, we do this because we are proactive and we want to be well. I don't want this bloody illness, excuse me, you know.
Yes.
I want to enjoy life, you know. So I did all these things. I spent years saying I do not have any illness consciousness. I do not have any illness. And I just went out and lived life. And I tell you, it didn't last very long until I was seriously ill. And we're being refused disability support pensions now if you have not done graded exercise therapy or cognitive behaviour therapy for false illness beliefs. It's just ludicrous.
To put what Penelope said, just to explain a little more, that's the one most shocking thing about this study. It was a questionnaire about physical function. Can you do this? Can you, you know, whatever, lift things or whatever? I don't know exactly what the questions are, but they're all about physical function. Most people, even many disabled people, somewhat disabled, would score 80, 85, something like that, 95, and so on. The original measure for recovery on physical function was 85. And as Penelope said in the study, you needed 65 or less to be entering the study. When they redid their analysis and when they published it, that 85 had dropped to 60. So basically, and 13% of the participants in the study already met that threshold of 60, so they were already recovered and disabled at the exact same time when they started the study for physical function. It's absolutely insane because no other study, you can't be disabled and recovered at the same time. You can't have breast cancer and not have breast cancer on a blood test or whatever at the same time. It's preposterous. Or HIV. So it's really ridiculous, and it got published in The Lancet and other major journals. And you point this out, it's like a mass delusion in the UK, among all the medical journals, among doctors. They all think this is science. It's total garbage. And that's the one thing of the study that has kept me interested. I'm like, how could a study with that be published, especially in The Lancet? And why, when you point it out, patients point it out, and they're called vexatious, belligerent, anti-science. I point it out, and, you know, universities complaining to my university to try to stop me from doing this reporting. It's insane. It's really insanity. They're really living in you know, I was giving a talk, and one of the things I was thinking, how do I shock this audience? Is like, you know, to see what I'm talking about. This is an audience of scientists. And I thought of getting up and taking off my clothes and saying, the emperor has no clothes in the UK. This is what this looks like. Here I am naked. And this is everybody in the UK medical establishment is like this. Because they're absolutely devoted to a totally ridiculous study. That's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
I wonder if it might be too political, but I wonder if you could mention that some of these investigators have really close ties to insurance companies in the UK.
I was going to ask that.
A vested interest in these people being refused support, you know, welfare benefits for being so sick.
Yeah, so
and also that so many scientists have publicly called for retraction from The Lancet. Because, you know, listeners won't realise that this is a really big deal in the scientific world to have such flawed research not being retracted.
So basically the three principal investigators all have ties to disability or insurance companies, and part of their life has been spent advising insurance companies that people with this illness should not get benefits unless they go through cognitive behavior therapy, graded exercise therapy. They did not disclose these to patients, these conflicts of interest to patients in their consent forms, and even though they promised in their trial protocol that they would. So from my perspective, they actually had no right to publish any data at all. One of the things is that that there was an open letter to The Lancet, which actually called for there were several studies. So there was an open letter to one journal called Psychological Medicine, signed by more than 100 people, that called for immediate retraction of those findings. The letter to The Lancet actually called for a sort of completely independent investigation of the findings. Only because it's very hard to get retractions and for complicated reasons. But the study really does need to be retracted, partly from my perspective, because they didn't have informed consent. They never told participants, as they promised to, that they had serious conflicts of interest. Because if you're advising insurance companies at the same time as you're investigating a study, it's obviously in your interest to get findings that will allow you to continue to tell the insurance companies what you've been telling them already. So they have very serious vested interests, which would have been okay, not really, but it would have been okay enough had they told patients about them in the study, as they promised to do. And somehow, again, this has just completely been ignored by The Lancet, the journals, the medical profession in the UK. It's really just shocking. Before I started reviewing it or writing about it, I checked with my colleagues at Berkeley, you know, epidemiologists. I'm not an epidemiologist or a medical scientist. I'm a social scientist, really. And they all said, they all just were absolutely appalled. They were like, how could this possibly ever have gotten published? You know, I mean, so this is uniform among my colleagues at Berkeley. So it was actually very easy when we wrote the first letter to The Lancet to get 42 people, you know, from Harvard, Berkeley, Columbia, Stanford, et cetera, University College London, to say this is just completely unacceptable science. And again, because it's hard to get retractions, that letter asked for just an immediate investigation, totally independent of anything in the UK, by people totally unaffiliated with the, you know, with the research and the researchers. So everybody you show the study to, the study is now used in Berkeley epidemiology graduate seminars, doctoral seminars, as a really wonderful pedagogical tool, as a case study of terrible science. So the students get the study for a few weeks, and they read that, and they spend 3 weeks sort of analyzing it, and then they do presentations to the class where they rip it to shreds. So I think that's the most effective use of the study, and the only thing it's really good for is as a pedagogical tool to show people how not to do a clinical trial. The other thing that it was good for is that, in effect, it proved that the treatments don't work. If the researchers had actually reported their original findings per the ones they promised to do in their protocol, they would have had to report, well, we really have nothing, we're sorry we've wasted everybody's time, but at least now we know that this theory is stupid and these treatments don't work. But that's not what they did.
Before we get on to part two, we reckon it's time to give you a little break. Here's something I prepared earlier, a tiny seed of hope. places under this same sun. Shadows drift, webs are spun, till fear has overtaken fun. Closed and safe, homes are damp, doors and walls, forge world's end. Outsiders never mix as friends. When love is lost, faith's been misplaced. Is a tiny seed of hope, hope enough? Times I venture out, I do, home alone in this human zoo. Been there, done that, deja vu. Like Mother Earth, feel the strain, try to hide from hurt and pain. But connections are all that will sustain. When love is lost, faith's been misplaced. Is a tiny seed of hope, hope enough? Ideas swish and swirl to find creative tones turned colorblind in this dark canvas of mine. I'd like to paint some lighter hues, to find another lover muse, some tango to replace these blues. When love is lost, faith's been misplaced. Is a tiny seed of hope, hope enough? Is a tiny seed of hope, hope enough? Is a tiny seed of hope, hope enough.
Okay, so NSFS activists in Australia have a small number of very clear goals for change. One of them is that we do want our people who are on, from every conceivable angle, severely disabled, and for whom the only evidence for recovery is this very flawed trial, we want those people to have access to the services of the NDIS. Some people have been receiving services for decades.
And they've been cancelled.
And they've had those services cancelled. So we do people with ME/CFS to have access to the NDIS. We also have great difficulty, a lot of our people, getting a disability support pension. Now, when someone who is bedbound cannot get a support pension that is designed for people who can only work 15 hours a week or less, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Again, these decisions are based on this very flawed research.
Yeah.
We're also very concerned that we should have an equitable amount of research funding based on economic burden, even if it's only based on economic burden. We should be getting many millions of dollars every year for medical research. We've had nothing. If we get something, it's not going to make up for all those lost years. We're looking for equity in medical research. The fourth one is we want health practitioners of every type to be trained in the realities of the illness. It's a common illness. It ought to be in curriculum. And what's in the curriculum needs to be based on medical science and not on this flawed study.
Yeah. You met with people in the agency?
So we had a phone conference later in the day for about an hour. And, you know, I mean, basically it was more kind of like a door opening kind of conversation, it felt like. They actually, you know, we were very clear that no one was blaming anybody. It was really just to sort of, you know, help them, you know, understand the complicated aspects of the illness and why sometimes, you know, people aren't getting services, that there's a misunderstanding in the way in what the illness is. You know, I talked about the PACE study. These treatments are really have been unproven rather than proven. People shouldn't be not getting benefits because they haven't done them. You know, and they seemed, you know, open to the discussion, which is about the most I can say. I mean, the most there is to say. You know, it left it open for further discussion. So, I mean, it's not for me to follow up because I'll be gone, but for local people. And one of the ideas was that, you know, there's an A list and a B list of illnesses, and this should probably be on the B list, but it's not. And so there was some idea that they may be revising that list later in the year. So there was some opening, you know, to maybe that this might be something that could be included or that would be discussed. So, you know, again, it's I think one of the problems is that there's certainly been a change among some doctors and certainly among some media, there's more interest. I think there's a general recognition because this controversy over this trial has been going on for 2 years that this trial is bad. It's not being cited in the same way as before. But all those things take a much longer time to work their way through the system and down to the sort of bureaucratic structures that people rely on to get benefits. And so I think one of the efforts was to kind of try to nudge that process a little bit. So the science, as far as I'm concerned, has been really debunked, and, you know, the study is a bad study. People who are really wedded to this belief that it's is somehow a self-induced or, you know, because of false illness beliefs, it's so ridiculous, the idea that millions of people around the world want nothing better than to spend 30 years of their lives in bed not working. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just insane. So I think there's been a shift, and you know, and I've seen it over working on this for 2 or 3 years, but again, that takes a much longer time to work down to the bureaucratic systems. And to be fair to NDIS or NDIA, you know, it's a fairly new program. This isn't exclusively the only thing people have difficulty with. A lot of people with a lot of illnesses are having trouble. This one has a particular set of issues around it that make it difficult, but they're not, I don't have the feeling that they're targeting these patients. It's just they have a convenient way not to provide services and everybody's trying to save money. So I don't think there's like an animus, I didn't feel in my conversation specifically targeting this patient population, but the way it's set up does have a particularly disproportionate impact on whether people can get services.
And the fact that people who had services have now had those services cancelled.
We're told that if you were receiving a current service, you would not be disadvantaged by the introduction of the NDIS. That's what you're referring to. People who got hack services were supposed to transfer to the NDIS. What has happened in practice, from the experience of people with ME/CFS, is they've had a hack service and the hack service has said, right, so you are automatically invited to apply for an NDIS package to replace your current services. However, when they apply, then they get rejected and their services stop. And that was not the intention at the time the NDIS was designed.
ME/CFS is not even seen as a permanent condition, so it's not even on their list of conditions, so people are just automatically rejected. And the people that have fought very hard to get onto the NDIS and have usually have other comorbidities that have helped them kind of like get in the door with their NDIS. And then when they have their planning meetings, their ME/CFS is recognised and provided for to some extent, but not to the extent where, for instance, if they're unable to walk, you know, that they can get scooters. It might just be that they can have an hour's cleaning once a fortnight. So it's, you know, it's really on the ground. It's just a total schmozzle, and people are either no services or B, losing services. And for someone who's got no family, you know, and they're single in their home, it can mean, you know, losing their independence in a home and in their own home, having to go into a nursing home. You know, that's the level of disability for, and the reality for a lot of our people. You know, we're not just a little bit tired, you know. People cannot walk, you know.
And I'd like to tell a quick little story, because people think of it as physically being unable to do things. Yeah. But one of the very strange things about this illness is when you do more than your body can cope with, everything gets worse. So I had the extraordinary experience of deliberately making myself sicker as part of a research study. 2-day bike test.
Oh,
I knew I was going to be extremely ill afterwards, but you do it for the sake of research. What I didn't expect was having arranged to take a taxi home, knowing that I would be physically unable to drive. I got in the taxi. I could not tell the driver my home address. Mm. I'd been living there for 15 years, and my brain could not, I could not retrieve from my memory my home address where I'd been living for 15 years. And that was because for 2 days in a row, I had done around 10 minutes on an exercise bike.
Yep.
And that shut my brain down so much that I couldn't remember my home address.
Now, that's a very common kind of experience.
And if that's not disabling, I don't know what it is.
The neurological sort of effects, I'm able to go out of the house generally at the moment about once a fortnight to a doctor's appointment. That doctor's appointments have been my only social contact for the last 2 years, except for the singing that I was able to do with Yusu, you know, maybe once a month or once a fortnight for an hour if I was lucky. It's my only social outing for the last 2 years. But I'll go to the doctors, and I actually, that exertion of going to the doctors physically, driving, walking, talking, I'm often unable to sign my signature. I just simply forget my signature. You know, I'm an articulate, intelligent person. You know, how could you forget to sign? And literally the pen is stuck on the page because the brain just won't do it. You know, that's the kind of disability. Or, you know, I'm at the doctors and I have to pay and my card gets rejected because I can't remember my PIN number.
And, you know, Tanya can't get a disability support pension because in theory she's able to go and work.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is that I had a previous disability support pension many years ago in the 90s when I was very, very sick with ME, but I rehabilitate. I love life. I want to work, you know, I want to participate. So I rehabilitated myself enough to work part-time and actually for a short time, very intensely full-time, which is wonderful. But with this illness, you always do too much. You always get another infection and crash. So now I'm in desperate need of help, and I've been stuck on Newstart for 2 years because I'm too unwell to get to the specialist.
And so you're on Newstart?
Yeah, I've been on Newstart under $270 a week for the last 2 years. You know, I've had to go and borrow money from family that is been very difficult to survive, you know, to keep my home, you know, to...
Newstart's not livable for anybody.
Of course not. It's like $160 below the poverty line.
Yes.
You know, and I've been diagnosed for close to 40 years. But because, my specialist has retired recently, you know, all those records are paper records. They're destroyed. And Centrelink says, well, until you can get another diagnosis, I mean, they won't take my, you know, other GPs and other doctors' word for it. It has to be from the diagnosing specialist. So I've had to go back on the specialist round, you know, be waiting for a year on a waiting list for a specialist to see me just to tell me that I've got something that I know I've had for 40 years just so I can get a disability support pension to survive.
That's just totally outrageous.
And I have no support.
Yes.
You know, I've had to get my elderly mother to go shopping and cooking for me, you know, because I can't do it myself, you know. I'm having to give up my dogs, potentially, because I can't look after them. You know, people don't realise that it's not because we're tired. You know?
Yes.
So one of the ways in which, for example, NDIS, the scheme, it doesn't, you know, the questions they ask don't quite work. And so let's say you have to fill out a questionnaire about what activities you can do. Can you take a shower? Yes. Can you go shopping? Yes. Can you cook? Yes. Well, if you have ME, you may be able to do all those things, but you can maybe only do one of them every 2 days. So you can take a shower today, but you can't cook or go shopping the same day because you need the rest of your, you've way over, you know, exceeded your energy reserves, and you can't do anything else that day because you have the kind of crash that Tanya talks about, or Penelope. So the form, you can say yes to all the questions, but it doesn't ask you, how often you can do them.
Or what price you pay for them. So as a general, so you adjust to very new normal. So I go out reasonably often for someone who's as ill as I am, but I don't have a shower and then go out on the same day.
No,
I go out unwashed because I have to make a choice.
Your best friends are wet wipes, you know. Yes. I might have a shower once a fortnight. That's unbelievable.
Yes. So then they say, can you have a shower? Well, yes, I can have a shower. I might only do it once a week and I do nothing else that day, but I can have a shower. So then they tick, I can have a shower. The people who are most severe would, for example, perhaps try and phone Centrelink, right? And that will knock them out and make them extremely ill for 3 days.
Totally.
And then they go, okay, but I didn't actually get through, so now I have to phone Centrelink again. So in the meantime, they haven't cleaned their teeth, they haven't eaten anything that doesn't come straight out of a packet, but they've got to go back to phone Centrelink. And again, that'll knock them out. I mean, it's just
like lurching from crisis to crisis to crisis. That's what my life feels like, just total damage control, you know. And yet there's this wonderfully, you know, intelligent, articulate person that has a great desire to contribute to the world and has enormous stuff to share and give, but it's just stymied at all levels. And, you know, it's a tough thing to talk about, but, you know, within the community we do talk about, you know, not being here because it's just...
Well, the suicide rate is very high.
Too hard. You know, you'd rather, you know, that you contemplate, not saying that you would, but you contemplate, do I want to exist at such a diminished level when there's just, it's like hitting your head against a brick wall constantly. You know, how long can you do that? You know, maybe 1 year, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, maybe 4 years. When you're pushing 40 years and it's just this relapsing, remitting cycle and I'm still justifying to people why I'm sick, I can tell you it is something you contemplate.
Yes, and people do it. The suicide rate is... I get all upset now because I know people who've taken their lives, who've made the decision, I have reached the limit of my ability to tolerate my life. So it's very personal.
And, yeah, and people judge you for that, you know, but they haven't walked in our shoes. And I can tell you it's something I deal with every single week. I think, I don't want to do this anymore. But, you know, I've got such a lust for life that I'm still here. There's some, you know, primal spark that goes... It doesn't matter, you know, you can keep going on, but it's very hard to articulate the despair that we live with.
Oh, and well, the isolation, clear,
you know.
One of the things that's sort of ironic is that basically people often get this, you know, they get a cold, they get glandular fever, then they get sick. The people who get the sickest are often the ones who are the most active, because basically they're the ones who can't stand, you know, if they were really diagnosed early and they were told, okay, just rest for a year in bed, you can, you know, that's the best way to sort of recover, if we're going to talk about recovery, is that if you catch early on and then you just rest and then you don't do anything and then your body kind of seems to find a way to mostly heal itself. You may be working, doing it at 70 or 80% level, but you're not. But people who are incredibly active, who are doing 25 things or 10,000 things in their lives, can't stand not doing anything for 6 months. And so they keep trying to push themselves. And because the medical profession has been in the business of telling people, push yourself, get back to work, get back to doing everything, the people who are the most active and the most engaged and the most full of, you know, lust for life or whatever, are the ones who end up often getting the sickest. And then they're called lazy and they're called malingerers or they're called whatever it is. It's really disgraceful. So, you know, I can say this because I don't have this, so I can sort of see it from the outside. I haven't experienced it, you know, luckily, but it's kind of astonishing when I started doing it to see all these people. You know, and the percentage rates are about maybe 0.4%, 0.5%. is the amount they sort of think. And, you know, in the U.S. we talk about 1 million people. In Australia they talk about 140,000, 150,000, or maybe 200,000. That's probably a little high. In the U.K. a 250,000 people. So it's a lot of people, but, you know, you don't see many of them because they're home. Many of them, you know, at any one time they think, estimate about 25% are homebound. And people don't talk about it because they're sort of embarrassed by it. They're ashamed. They're made to feel ashamed that they have this illness with this horrible name. So, you know, no one really talks about it in polite company often. I think that's probably true. So most people have no idea that, you know, it was like, I mean, I'm a gay man, so I was in the 80s and, you know, coming of age in New York when everybody was dying that I knew. Straight people didn't talk about it. They had no idea that, you know, half the people one knew were all dying because it was sort of something just happening. This is sort of similar in a way that there's all these people who were sick, and many more people than I ever thought that I'd come into contact with, that are just homebound and having these really, completely constrained, limited lives. It's really a disgrace.
So if you got the services that you required, so if you got assistance to shower, etc.?
No, I've got nothing.
But not if you even, did, if you did, that would at least take away some of the stigma and some of the the stuff that you have to endure.
You saw me walk in with a cane today because I'm having some difficulties. You know, if I've got a cane, I get much more respect than if, you know, if I say that I've got, because I do, I have, you know, arthritis of the spine, etc. You know, but that causes me my least of my worries. But yes. I get much more respect if I have a physical looking disability than the real truth.
I understand
so
that.
I'm a bit of a stalwart. I just go, well, you know, bugger it, you know, I've got ME and I want people to face that head on. So I just, you know, use that. But I can tell you it causes me a lot of social disconnection, and I'm treated like a pariah. I actually get quite despairing after wonderful events like David's public talk last night, because I spend all of my available energy inviting, you know, intelligent, articulate, you know, community-based people to come and listen to the difficulties that we face, and they don't come, you know. And everyone talks about community and connection and how healing and how important it is, and tribe, and, you know, to me it's just like empty rhetoric, you know, and it's very hard for me to come to terms with that.
I'll say one more thing, sort of relates to what Tanya was saying, which is that these medical professionals, these psychiatrists, the ones who have been proposing this thing, they've really been gaslighting the patient community for decades and treating them like they're, you know, and I've been writing about this now for 2.5 years. And when I've tried to talk to these people, or when I read what they write, they're basically saying up is down, black is white, blue is red. You know, they're basically, you say red is red, and they say no, blue is red. And you say no, blue is blue, and they say no, green is yellow. I mean, it's insane. And so basically, I'm a healthy, robust 61-year-old guy, and it's driven me just bonkers. I'm just insane with this because it drives you nuts. It's very hard for me to imagine what it's like to be a complete, you know, really disabled patient, and, you know, you're facing this kind of thing for 30 years, and not just professionally, as I've been facing it trying to write about this stuff, but in your family, with your employers, and people telling you you're not sick. It would drive anybody absolutely insane or suicidal or anything. And I can't even imagine, you know, it's horrible to be sick. It's then horrible to be, have everybody think you're not sick and you're just making it up. The one thing about AIDS, which was horrible, but at least people were dying, so people could had to acknowledge that there was actually something killing them and an actual disease. Otherwise, nobody cared, but nobody could deny that there was a disease going on. This is a different situation. People do die, you know, in extreme cases, but mostly people are not dying unless they kill themselves. That's and so nobody actually, they don't look sick when you see them, because they gather their energy together to look presentable in public like anybody would. Then they go home and collapse for a month and you don't see them, and then they're told that they're not sick. And so it's understandable that the patient community is, you know, in a state. And it, you know, it's a terrible situation to be in.
With regard to dying, the classic joke is that someone gets told, I'm really sorry to tell you, but you have any CFS. The good news is it probably won't kill you. The bad news is it probably won't kill you, because you're going to live with it.